Coming up next, it's DIY Portland with host Julie Sabatier. This month, the show goes technical and explores the world of open source software with guests from Free Geek and other local organizations working to provide alternatives to the world of Microsoft. Stay tuned for that. I'm Julie Sabatier, and you're listening to KBOO's monthly show about revolutionary do-it-yourself projects. This month, we're getting a little technical. We'll be talking about open-source software and access to computer technology. I spoke with Brian Jameson, the CEO of a company called Open Sorcery. Open Sorcery customizes open-source software packages for small businesses and nonprofits. They provide technical assistance for their clients as well. I asked Brian Jameson to lay out the basics for us. So why don't you tell us, what is open source software?
Maybe I can start by telling you what open source software isn't, because most people use software that is not open source. So when you go to the store and you buy software, you're not actually buying the software, you're buying a license to the software. So if you want to change the software or do anything with it, typically the license tells you, you can't do that. Well, open source software is about doing things with software and about making it better and giving people the power to make it better. So when you get the actual software that's open source, you can make changes to it yourself, or you can have other people make changes to it. You have the rights to change the software. And that's totally revolutionized the way that software has been done. Basically, before, you had big operating systems like Microsoft where they were charging, X amount of dollars for you to have their operating system or their word processing program or whatever. And if you wanted them to make a change to it, you had to basically pray that they would fix it or anything. With open source software, if you have an issue with it, like say there's a bug or there's some sort of security hole or anything like that, or you want to change, because you have the source code to it, you're able to make the changes yourself.
And what is source code?
So source code is kind of like the blueprint to a house. You wouldn't build a house without a blueprint, and you can't build a piece of software without the source code. So if you have the source code, you can actually go in and make any kind of change you want to the software. You can add functionality to it. You can fix bugs. You can make one pixel move to the left, whatever you need to do. If you don't have the source code, you're out of luck. You can't do any of that.
What are some open source programs that people might be familiar with?
Well, if anyone's ever used the internet, they've used open source software, right? So Google is based on open source software. Most of the web servers that run web pages, the vast majority of them run open source software. Apache is the name of the web server that runs it. Firefox is something that a lot of people probably know and use. It's the most sophisticated and secure web browser out there that I highly recommend everyone use. OpenOffice, which is a free alternative to Microsoft Office and includes Word compatible, PowerPoint compatible, Excel compatible, but it's free.
And how can people access those programs?
Typically, you can just go out and download open source software. So it depends on what you're looking for. But typically, there's a certain amount of technical expertise that's required to install any kind of software. So you want to work with someone who's technically competent to put it together for you.
And that's what you do at Open Sorcery, right?
Yes, that's what we do. We take the, maybe there's 100,000 open source packages out there, and we can tailor them to people's needs. And it ends up being vastly cheaper than going out and buying some proprietary piece of software. And typically works much better. We set up people's systems so that they can collaborate, whether that's setting up like a wiki or content management system for their web page.
What's a wiki?
A wiki is something that was invented in Portland, and it's a web page that can be edited by anybody just by clicking on the page. It doesn't require any technical expertise at all. And so suddenly you have web pages that anyone can edit and collaborate with. So Wikipedia is probably the best example of this, which now it's an open system, and it's now got more content than Encyclopedia Britannica, right? So it's, and is widely regarded as more authoritative than Encyclopedia Britannica. So wikis offer that kind of functionality. And they're open source. Most of them are open source, so you don't have to pay for the software, and you get really phenomenal functionality with them. So we do that. And we also do custom software development.
So why is open source software better in some ways for nonprofits and small businesses, which you work with a lot, than proprietary software?
It's better for so many reasons. One reason is open source software is typically a lot more secure than proprietary software. And the reason why it's more secure is more people have access to it. And the more people that have access to it, the more people that are looking at it and improving it. So you tend to have, by and large, vastly less security issues with open source software, which is just huge for an organization. I mean, you don't want big security holes because there's hackers running around running scripts all day long looking for security exploits on the internet. It's a really dangerous place out there. So open source software is a good protection for that. It's also a huge cost saver because you don't have to pay a license fee up front. Typically, the open source software is either very, very cheap or free for the software. So you're only paying for the installation of the software and the customization of it and the maintenance of it. And typically, also, the maintenance of it is lots cheaper. And that's one of the reasons why most of the internet is run off of open source software. Not just because it's cheaper up front, but because it's cheaper all the way across the board for all the maintenance. And it's also because you can learn how to do it yourself, right? You can learn how to administer your own machines. You can learn how to take care of your own software. It's really phenomenal.
What kind of rates do you charge for the services you provide to small businesses and nonprofits?
We have a sliding scale, so we have a special rate for nonprofits. And we typically only work with organizations that we consider sustainably minded or at least explicitly not evil, if that makes sense.
And how much technical expertise do people need to have in order to manipulate their own software?
It depends on what you want to do. If you just want to use the software from a user's point of view, like if you want just want to use your email or if you want to use your web browser or anything like that, it's very low. But then as you get into more sophisticated things, if you want to, say, administer your own email server or if you want to modify the actual source code, the actual programs, it gets to be fairly sophisticated. It's not impossible. I think there's a huge amount of avenues for helping people out. And that's one of the things that I think is really awesome about open source is there's a huge, huge community of people. I mean, just hundreds of thousands of people out there. So when you have a question, you go to an online forum and you get answers back, sometimes within an hour or two. Typically within a day, you get an answer to your question that points you on your way. So it facilitates that kind of learning. So you can start out with almost no knowledge and then get yourself up to a pretty high level. And a lot of people have done that with open source. Getting back to some of the reasons why people ought to use open source software, like if you're an organization, right, and you have software, you're kind of held hostage by the company that has your software, right, that makes the software. And you're held hostage because if they decide to upgrade the software that you're using, and you want some features in your software, or you want a bug fix or a security fix or something like that, you're basically forced to pay the money for the new version. And if you don't do that, then eventually your support options will go away. So you'll have no support. They orphan the product. So then basically you have no option whatsoever. You're sitting with a piece of software that's not supported. It might have serious security issues. There's no way to update it or modify it. And if the company goes out of business or decides to discontinue the product, there's nothing you can do except go with a completely different product or pay money to upgrade it. And I think that's an unacceptable alternative. I think an organization that is deploying any kind of software should control the software, right? It should be theirs. So if they want to improve it, they can decide, we're going to pay to improve this. You can do that with open source. You can't do that with closed software, proprietary software. You can always, if you have the source code, you can always find somebody who will provide you service, which is a huge, huge thing. Totally puts the power in the organization's hands.
I have a Mac, and every maybe 3 weeks or so when I turn it on, it says, would you like to download these updates to your software?
Yeah.
So, I mean, proprietary software is updatable at some point. What is the difference between that and maybe what open source would offer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, first of all, are you using OS X?
Yes.
So that's based on open source software, right? That's one of the reasons
why. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's right. And that was Apple being smart and saying, there's some really fabulous software out there. We're gonna leverage this. And they did a lot to it. But basically, that's why it's so powerful. So the idea of downloading updates originated with open source. Most innovation, the vast majority of innovation in software is coming out in open source, and it gets picked up later by proprietary software. So, yeah. You can download software updates, but those are updates to your existing, already purchased software. So you already bought the operating system OS X for your Mac, and you already bought whatever programs you got. I'm talking about on my Linux-based open source system. If I don't already have a video editing package, I can go out and just download it for free, and it just installs on my system. If I want an MP3 player, I mean, whatever I want to do, there's typically software out there that's pretty darn good.
Tell me about Linux.
Well, where to start? Linux is really amazing. I've been using Linux for about 11 years, and it started out with this guy just saying, here's this thing that I've done, what do you think? And posting it on the internet. People liked it, and they started collaborating and improving it. And it's grown to this enormous thing. I mean, Google is powered by Linux. I mean, huge, huge organizations are powered by Linux. And many small ones are powered by it, too. Like, everything in open sorcery is powered by Linux. So, what is it? It's this enormous, collaboratively produced collection of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of software that work together. And most of them are free or nearly free. I mean, you can download Linux, you know, for free, put it in your computer, and boom, it just works.
And it's an operating system, right?
It's an operating system like Windows or OS X. In my opinion, it's vastly superior to Windows. It's more secure, hugely more secure. It's designed to be a network operating system from the ground up, right? So what that means is it's safer to use, and it supports things that you want, like being able to download programs off the internet and things of that nature.
What is the future of open source software? I mean, is it going to eventually phase out Windows, Microsoft, things like that?
I believe that open source software is the only way to develop software. And I'm a geek. I mean, I am a diehard geek. I've always been a geek. I mean, when I was 11 years old, I was spending my time in Radio Shack playing around on computers. And I use technology that works. And I believe in open source, and I believe in what it means, but it also has to work. And if it didn't work for me, I wouldn't use it. And it's just a better way to develop software. So instead of just closing it off and being in this little small environment, you're actually contributing to humanity, because you know when you release products under open source, people are going to contribute to them, and they'll get better over time. So it's very satisfying, but it also works better. So if you look at two things that I think people can relate to really well, software browsers, right? Web browsers. You have Internet Explorer, typically, that people use, and Firefox as a comparison. Internet Explorer, what, it's got all sorts of problems. It's got huge security issues. I mean, just enormous. And there's still, right now, security issues in it, even in IE7, which was just released. You could drive trucks through it. I mean, it's really dangerous. But it also doesn't have a lot of really interesting functionality to it. You compare that to Firefox, which is pretty stable. I mean, it doesn't have, it isn't completely without faults. And there are occasionally security issues that get fixed just with any software. But by and large, it's really bulletproof. But it also has really neat functionality in it, right? Firefox, they're the guys who did tabbed browsing years ago, tabbed browsing in Firefox. But they also have this really neat plug-in technology where you can actually modify web pages that are on that you typically go to and say, I don't want to see that part of the web page ever. And it just gets rid of it forever. So when you come back later, it's not there. And just huge amounts of things. Like there's a little plugin somebody wrote for Firefox that allows you to see just the negative comments on eBay reputations, which is a small thing, right? But someone had a scratch, and they wanted to itch it. So they built this thing, and now thousands of people can leverage it. And all you have to do is plug it into your Firefox browser, and you have that functionality. You can't do that in IE. And it's not designed to take advantage of that because it's not open source. They just don't have that mentality. And it's pretty well acknowledged that open source is the way to develop software these days. The people who aren't acknowledging it are the ones who have a financial stake in making the money the way that they've done.
But is this collaborative model, does it have the potential, do you think, to surpass the corporate model?
That's a big, deep question, but I do think so. Yeah. It's kind of like the turtle and the hare. I mean, the corporate model is release fast, make lots of money, don't think past the next quarter, right? And that works in some cases, and that's got us some interesting things. The collaborative model is more longer term, and it's taken a long time for Firefox to get to... It took Firefox a long time to get to where it was good enough, but then very quickly it got better and continued to get better, whereas IE, Internet Explorer, just hasn't caught up, and it never will catch up ever again now. Now that Firefox has surpassed it, they won't be able to catch up. It's not possible because of just the sheer number of hours. I mean, there's thousands of people working on Firefox. I don't care how rich Microsoft is, they're not going to be able to keep up with that. And that's sort of the history of that. So I definitely think collaborative development is going to surpass this proprietary corporate development. Now, corporations still contribute to open source, and that's great. We wouldn't have open source if corporations were contributing to it. We all have to work together.
Is there any kind of movement in the corporate world to defame open source software? I mean, you say Mac is using it, but I mean, how does Microsoft feel about it? Do they feel threatened?
Oh, yeah, they've been threatened for a long time. The big joke is there's sort of three stages. One, they laugh at you. Two, they fight you. And three, they join you. So we're kind of moving from phase two to phase three now, where early on they were, you know, there's no way that this company is going to be, you know, this idea is going to be able to take over our company. But things, particularly with Microsoft, they've seen that Linux and open source is really eating them up, and it's taking a big bite out of a lot of their different divisions. So they're definitely threatened by it. They have their own open source initiatives that I think eventually they will be forced to become an open source company and a much smaller, much different company. I don't think they're ever going to go away. But I think everyone is going to be forced into this model. As more and more businesses realize they have the power to own the software and literally own it in the sense that they can make their own changes, why would you do anything else?
But that's pretty much all the specific questions I had. Is there anything else that you want to say about open sourcery or open source itself?
There's so much to be said about open source, and there's just no way you could cover all the details. But there's a reason why people are using it. And I think the reason why open source hasn't been as successful or as well understood by people who aren't in the technical community is because there's no one well-funded group out there promoting it. You have to discover it on your own. And because of that, organized corporations who have big marketing budgets can basically say whatever they want, and, you know, they get their agendas across really well. So it's really a matter of grassroots education that's really made it so popular and is carrying it forward.
Thanks for talking with me.
Sure. Thank you.
You're tuned to DIY Portland, where we've been hearing an interview with Brian Jameson of Open Sorcery about open source software. Open source software is very DIY, especially if you're a programmer and you know how to manipulate software source code if it's open to you. But what if you don't even have a computer? There's an ever-widening digital divide among people who can afford computer technology and people who can't. FreeGeek is working to change that. FreeGeek is a volunteer-powered organization that recycles computer parts and rebuilds computers. They also teach basic computer skills to seniors, students, and low-income people who might not otherwise have access to this technology. FreeGeek sells computers and parts at very low rates in their store, but they also offer them to volunteers in exchange for their work. Anyone who volunteers 24 cumulative hours at the organization can get a computer for free. FreeGeek uses the Linux operating system on all of the computers they build, sell, and give away. And they offer tutorials on how to use open source technology. I visited FreeGeek at their Southeast Portland location, and build coordinator Martin Chase took the time to show me around.
Here's card and motherboard sorting, where people learn the names of individual bits inside the computer. Macintosh stuff, we don't touch that. We send it down to Eugene. Advanced testing, we test hard drives and RAM and processors and motherboards. Monitor testing. Monitors have to be tested for an hour. They burn in and have to display good colors. Recycling is one of the funner areas. You get to destroy computers. There's everybody ripping them apart there. Room behind that wall there, that's the black hole, which is where laptops are dealt with, just everything dealing with laptop. Big boxes full of stuff to be recycled, sold for their copper or gold or steel content. Completed systems that we're going to hand out to nonprofit organizations and volunteers in various forms or another. My office, I'll show you. It would have been my office, except it got full of the classic gaming library, which is all the old video games, as well as just stuff that people would want to steal, RAM and hard drives and stuff. This is system evaluation. This is where people open up computers and figure out if they're worth keeping, and they also try and turn them on, and they learn some of their first basic troubleshooting skills here. This room is build. This is where we assemble computers, install operating systems on them, and double-check them to make sure that they work. This is our server room. All recycled hardware that are running our websites and our email servers and whatnot. This is a classroom on one side, and there's a stage there. We occasionally do events, I guess, parties with bands and stuff. This is a meeting room here. We have lots of meetings. It's consensus run, so that means we have to have lots and lots of meetings. This is the white hole as opposed to the black hole, and here we deal with server class hardware, stuff that was $6,000 or $10,000 when it was new. Oh, and the store. We sell stuff in here, and people buy it, and they like it.
Walking through FreeGeek on a Saturday, I met a variety of interesting people who were there for all kinds of reasons.
Can I ask you what you're working on?
Huh?
Can I ask you what you're working on?
I'm not busy if you need help.
I don't need any help. I'm actually just asking people about FreeGeek for KBOO.
Oh, okay. Well, right now I'm teaching the build class today. If anybody has any problems building their computers, I'm here to help them out if there's any problems at all. I've built several computers myself, and so I decided that I wanted to help help other people build their computers.
What's your name?
Michael.
And how old are you?
13.
And how is it teaching a class full of grown-ups?
Surprisingly enough, nobody's really ever minded very much that they're questions are being answered by kids. Nobody's ever really minded. I don't mind.
What do you like about FreeGeek?
it's very community oriented. Like, everybody helps each other out. Everybody cares about everybody else. Everybody's here to help. And it's just a very nice atmosphere.
I'm installing an IDE cable into the hard drive as part of the building process.
Did you know anything about building computers before you came here?
No. Not a thing. Nothing. I hadn't even been on an electric typewriter. So this is all brand new.
So what made you decide to come down here?
Because I heard that I could get a computer if I volunteered for 24 hours. And after I got the computer, I realized that I didn't know what to do with it. So I got into the build program. And it gives you a great deal of hardware experience, hands-on experience, plus the Linux exposure also. So it's been good. I've been 10 months, and now I'm an assistant instructor.
What's your name?
Tony. Go ahead and boot it up.
My name's Barrett. I'm just looking on the internet right now. I volunteer my time here because I'm homeless and on the street and I have nothing better to do, and I enjoy it.
I'm here as an activist who is trying, just literally struggling for freedom of speech as we speak, and it's a great place. Free Geek is a great place.
My name's Sophia, and I'm a paid intern here, so it's a job experience position to give me something stronger to put on my resume, and I work at the front desk. And what I really like about Free Geek is that it gives people a place to go to learn about technology. You know, it's open to anyone, regardless of your past experience, whether you've never touched a computer before or if you have a bachelor's in computer science. And it's a really good way just to, you know, be a part of that. And the environmental aspect is great. My favorite thing is probably the community, though. I love the people here.
Just another day in paradise.
The Build program is the primary teaching and learning tool at Free Geek. Every computer that comes in has to be broken down into parts so that each component can be tested and replaced if necessary. Here's Martin again.
There's a lot of just peer-to-peer education, a lot of people giving back immediately and just trying to help each other raise themselves up to the level of being competent with computer equipment and a lot of teaching themselves how to do it themselves.
You've been listening to DIY Portland. I'm Julie Sabatier, and that's all the time we have for this show. Just to recap, I spoke with Brian Jameson, the CEO of an organization called Open Sorcery. If you want to find out more about them, go to opensorcery.com. I also took a little tour of Free Geek, and you can find out more about the organization that's been helping the needy get nerdy since the year 2000 at freegeek.org. Thanks for tuning in to DIY Portland. This show is on the third Thursday of the month at 10 a.m. To access downloads, podcasting, and information about past and future shows, come visit me at www.myspace.com/JulieOnTheRadio.
And this is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, November 16th. Coming up next on Art Focused, host Julie Bernard speaks with members of the Northwest Print Council, Barbara Mason and Stephen LaFarre. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, an Argentine torture survivor talks about her return to the police station where she was abused, and an editor at the Los Angeles Times discusses how he was forced out of his job after he rejected job cuts. All that coming up this morning on KBOO Portland, your community-sponsored radio station. But first, we will have Art Focused, and before we do that, just let me say this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, featuring hundreds of artisans, foods from around the world, and local music and performance groups every Saturday and Sunday from March to December 24th. Information at portlandsaturdaymarket.com. And now stay tuned for Art Focus.
Écoutez, répétez.
Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. When I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile.
Oh, man.
But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism.
what you say, Cezanne.
Bonjour, monsieur et madame. This is
Bonjour, madame.
We are doing Art Focuses is entertaining the Northwest Print Council this morning, the Print Arts Northwest. The Print Council, Print Arts Northwest.
We.
And this morning, we're celebrating 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're promoting the fine art of printmaking mm-hmm. here this morning. And I have with me Barbara Mason. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning, Julie.
Good morning. And she is a superb printmaker. We'll hear from her a little bit about her own prints. But mostly we're going to celebrate this morning the Print Arts Northwest. And Tad Laflar, Stephen Laflar, is here. And I think everybody in the art world knows who Stephen is. He gets around. What are you doing this very minute now down there at PNCA?
Well, at PNCA, we're going through the archives of 100 years of paintings. It's time, but it's also in 2 years will be the centennial celebration of the Museum Art School, PNCA. And there's a lot of beautiful painting that is tucked away by teachers from long time ago. There's, there's an early work by, we were just looking at René Rickabaugh, a very early painting, like second year of art school.
Oh, yeah.
There was an early Clifford Wilson. We were looking at an early Clifford Wilson. It's very, there was a Jim Hibbard that is a triptych painting, and it looks just like a Jack McLarty. So you know who his teacher was. It's fascinating.
That happens with students. Sometimes they do the same thing their teachers are doing.
One of the best ways to learn.
Sure, it is. If you can, but you don't want to let it hang on too long after you get out of school,
yeah.
Which sometimes happens. It goes for a little bit too long.
Yeah.
But and Barbara Mason.
Yes.
Did you go to PNCA?
No. Well, actually, I did take lithography there, but I didn't go there to graduate. I'm originally from Seattle.
Okay.
And I've been to a lot of different schools. Started at the University of Washington, went to Portland State, Merrillhurst, Oregon School of Arts and Crafts when it was called OSAC, and then took one lithography class at PNCA. As soon as I discovered printmaking, I quit taking anything else.
I see. Well, now let's discuss a little bit what's at what are you showing at PNCA now to celebrate? You had a big party, didn't you?
We had a big party.
And people said some important things.
We have an amazing exhibit up now. It's a national juried show. There are 62 pieces juried from 600, and it was juried by Sam Davidson from Davidson Galleries in Seattle. And the work is truly amazing. It's just across the board with printmaking. There's just everything is there. So it's a very, very interesting show, very educational.
Okay. And two famous artists who are down there at the Print Center. Who are those people? Would you describe them a little bit? They're our friends.
George Johansson and Jack McLarty are having a dual show at Print Arts Northwest Gallery on 12th between Gleason and Flanders.
Yes.
And their work is, of course, just amazing, and they've been around beyond forever, but we hope to keep them an awful long time longer. I don't know if we'll be able to do that, but...
Both of them are able to do a lot of different things, and the show is interesting because essentially we're just showing Jack McLarty's prints and George Johansson monotypes. So it's quite fascinating. And George is always inventing. So to see his monotypes is often like seeing nobody else's in the world.
Now, print people are different, aren't they?
Print people do it backwards.
Yeah.
They are different.
They're interested in backwards.
And they're very willing to share their technology. Other media, they're not quite so willing. But with printmakers, if somebody develops something new, they can't wait to tell everyone and show them how they did it. So the sharing of technology is a unique thing. Plus, they trade work. Other people don't necessarily trade paintings. It takes a long time to do a painting. But when you're working in multiples and you can make 50 of something, it's real easy to trade it with other artists. So most printmakers have phenomenal collections of work.
Yes. And they are always discussing what they found out about certain styles or certain kinds of inks that they're using and certain kinds of changes in some that they discovered by mistake, kind of.
Exactly.
And they share these with each other most of the time, don't they?
Mm-hmm. They do.
Do they ever keep secrets?
Well, I don't think they keep secrets too much, but I'll tell you one thing. Printmaking is getting safer. Everything is going non-toxic. People are cleaning up with salad oil and water. They're not using solvents anymore. It's a huge change. It's a very exciting time to be a printmaker.
Yeah.
The new technology, we go hand in hand with the commercial printing industry. So every time there's a new jump in technology there, it's a new jump in hand printmaking. And, as I said, it's getting much safer. There are plates now that expose with UV light and wash out with water. So there are no chemicals involved. So it's just there's a wonderful new ink that's water soluble that reacts pretty much like oil-based ink. So it's very exciting.
It is very exciting. And, printmakers are very, it's almost a closed corporation. I think of printmakers as having some secrets that they are protecting, a lot of their ways of doing things. Is that true, do you think?
I disagree, actually. I think printmaking is revolutionary in a couple of ways. The first way is that it's always reinventing itself. And there's a lot of sharing of that invention because... Among printmakers, because it's not something that you can actually patent. It seems like sooner or later, somebody's going to find out what kind of viscosity you're using or how you're working the plate. But the other revolution is what started about, I would say, 600 years ago when printmaking first was invented. That's still valid. And it's kind of an unusual profession where you have something as ancient as that. For instance, the etching presses are virtually unchanged over half a millennium. Although they're machined a little better, they're very similar to what Rembrandt would have used. So that revolution is still with us. The other revolution is the reinvention.
And, of course, there's still woodblock, you know, where people are carving a piece of wood and putting ink on it and printing it. In fact, Print Arts Northwest, because it's our 25th year, we've been doing a lot of exciting things this year. And we brought a printmaker from Japan who taught a week-long workshop at Merrillhurst University this summer. And he hand-carried work from 15 contemporary printmakers from Japan, people who he knew that were professional artists, and he curated the work, and we're doing a show that's going to be shown at Waterstone Gallery, which is right next door to Print Arts Northwest.
Yes.
It opens December 7th, and it's going to be just a wonderful show. Everyone who's seen the work is just amazed.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because if you hadn't, I would have, because I got information just a couple of days ago about the show that's coming up. You have the show coming up. And do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Do you want to share that discussion, Tad?
Well, I don't know that Stephen's been as involved in it as I have. I'm actually physically framing all the work right now. I've got it all over my kitchen table.
I see.
And we're almost finished framing it. And the work is across the board, just like you'd get with 15 artists here. You know, some of it's very traditional, some of it's very contemporary. Woodblock by nature is pretty controlled, but a lot of this work is loose by woodblock standards. So I think everyone who comes will find something that they're interested in and that they'll like.
Okay.
That's kind of the spectrum of printmaking. It runs between discipline and sheer joy of making. And I think printmaking comes closest to pulling those two elements tightly together, because you must have both of them. And so craft is very important. And I think printmakers tend to come together and talk shop more than other kinds of artists, because it just is a part of the trade. It's really fun.
Okay. I'm thinking in terms of the people that are listening who don't really know what a lot of printmaking is about. And they may have something on their walls that they aren't sure what the heck of it is, but they know that they paid quite a lot of money for it. And they don't, but they aren't, they like the subject matter. And it does remind them of the gorge and the river and the trees and what have you. But it's called an etching. And they don't, a lot of people don't know what an etching is. And, sometime, maybe not today, but sometime what I'd like you to do is come on the air and we'll open the phones and get people with weird things on their walls to call and we'll give them a little education in how that was, what that probably is. Can we do that without them even seeing it? I think we could try.
That would be fun. But you know, simply printmaking is easy to define. It's a reproducible image that comes from a matrix, basically.
Yeah,
the matrix is a pattern that is set that can be reproduced. For instance, it can be a potato stamp, it can be a stencil, it can be anything that you can make more than one copy of. Uh-huh. So it has a lot of interesting repercussions that go into industry and into other disciplines as well.
Well, traditionally what happens is that it first of all, it reverses. I mean,
it reverses,
which is quite a surprise to some
I think
people.
We, as printmakers, we just get used to knowing that. And
you know
I always
that.
Feel if it's a good composition left to right, it's good right to left. But it definitely depends on the subject matter. Words look really funny backwards.
Well, this is quite a surprise, especially to a young person who hasn't been in the studio for very long. What happens when nature does what it does is a part of the beauty of it, at least for me, is this is the grand surprise. When you've done everything you can do, you print it, and it spreads in places where you didn't think it would.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It says what it wants to say.
Technically, printmaking is complicated, but it doesn't have to be. I do an awful lot of work as the education chair at Print Arts Northwest. I do an awful lot of work with children, and I go and I teach classes to pretty much anybody that can get a group together. I'll come and do a demonstration. And one of the things that we do is printmaking without a press, where we show you 50 ways you can do printmaking where you don't need any equipment but a wooden spoon and a rolling pin and your kitchen table. So there are very low-tech things that you can do without equipment that are pretty easy. And the children are such fun to work with. I have a real good time working with them. Every class
they get very excited, don't they?
Well, I tell them about the paper and I say, you know, this is very special 100% cotton rag paper, and I ask them where cotton comes from. And it doesn't matter the age. I mean, even up to sixth or seventh grade, I'll say, where do you think cotton comes from? And somebody will say, sheep. Every single class. It's just amazing. And then, of course, so everybody kind of laughs who, you know, it's a thing. They don't think about it. They just say it. And then, of course, we discuss it coming from plants. But, it's just real cute how they, think cotton comes from sheep.
Yeah, well, that's exciting for everybody when, the children, expand that way in seeing something new, and
right.
And it will stay with them forever.
Well, we hope so. We wish we had a bigger education program. There's no way we can meet the demand. I mean, we go where we're invited if we can, but we can't always because there are just so few of us.
Okay. Like how many are there? And you're all teachers?
We have all been teaching a long time, so I would say we're all teachers.
Yeah.
And there are actually four of us that take turns going into schools, and I wish we had 40.
Okay.
It would be
good to
have 40. Yeah.
There surely would. And do you do any teaching then, Stephen?
I was at Lincoln High School yesterday and talking with a class with Cindy Irby, and it was fascinating. I mean, yeah. I'm not a teacher. I never studied teaching or anything, but I love to learn, and I think teaching is partly learning.
Uh-huh.
But we were talking about drawing, and that drawing is a prelude to a lot of printmaking. You know, you mentioned that how do we deal with the things backwards? It seems like printmaking is a little bit arcane, almost like alchemy at times. But in truth, it's something that everybody does all the time. It's just a discipline and a skill that you learn. For instance, working backwards is no problem. When you're driving your car and you look in the rearview mirror, you have no question about which side of the car things are happening behind you. It's backwards, but you just have learned to accommodate yourself to that mirror image. I'm told that we actually see upside down, that the light goes through the iris and hits the back of the eye upside down. So there are so many things that we can accomplish without knowing it. And then finally, even writing with a pencil, that pencil, when you first put it in the hand of somebody who doesn't know how to write, is very awkward, or learning to use a spoon as opposed to chopsticks. And printmaking is a similar thing. It's one decides at what level of skill you want to stop, basically.
Right. There, it's
when to stop.
It's technically yeah. Huge. You can spend years and years and years going from one process to another, and I'm sort of a process junkie, so I've certainly done that. And I think that knowing all those processes has made me much, much better at what I actually do. But I could do it probably just having studied the one process too. I don't think you have to learn everything.
For me, I'm the opposite.
Yeah, I just want to learn it all.
I quickly arrived at a point where I was getting confused, dealing with certain kinds of spit bites and white grounds. And I decided I'm going to work my art as simply and straightforward and as far as I can by line drawing. And so although I wasn't very good at line drawing, I settled on it and did it for a long time, and I'm better.
You're good at it. You do beautiful work. I've seen it.
Thanks.
I mean, and it's very sensitive work. How do you... There's one problem that I've been wanting to get you guys to talk about. It doesn't have anything to do really with what we're talking about now, or I don't think it does. Maybe it does. How does somebody like Salvador Dali, who's been dead for many, many years, and persons have taken his work and made prints, and he's been dead for a long time, but the word is that he signed a whole bunch of paper.
Oh, the word is exactly right. He did do that.
Is this really true?
Well, in a way,
did you know that?
I think Dali was perhaps the first Andy Warhol. One might say Duchamp was, but Dali was also. And Dali, at the same time as being actually a pretty good artist and a great psychologist, you know, with what's called paranoid vision and all.
Uh-huh.
He was also kind of undermining the assumptions of capitalism, I think.
Yeah, he definitely was a promoter.
He promoted himself a lot,
definitely
didn't
did.
He?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What they were, he painted what they were ready for.
Well, and unfortunately, you know, when that kind of thing happens, it gives art in general a bad name. You know, the whole editioning thing where, you know, you have an edition of 50 prints, it was really originally created by galleries who wanted to make things more valuable. So they said, well, there's only 50 of these. So when you get to 49, it makes that one more valuable because there's only two left. And I don't know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. You know, a printmaker can do an awful lot of work in a year because they do multiples. A painter... you can only physically paint so many paintings, but when you're making an etching and you get your plate done and then you can print it, once you get to that point, you can print quite a few copies. So it's a whole different venue than painting.
Sure it is.
And, you know, in another way, that's a very valuable tool because generally it makes an artist think a little more about what they're doing.
Yes.
Because it's going to live on. You know, there's the saying, life is short, art is long. And I think Dali, by signing a bunch of blank pieces of paper, is making sure his art is long.
Really long.
But I find printmaking, for me at least, is kind of related to literary arts and forms of thinking. And I appreciate that a lot. There's a certain amount of spontaneity, but on the other hand, because you're working so long and hard on the matrix, on the plate or whatever, you think about it. And as Hockney calls it, there's the element of layered time. Just the history of your work goes into it.
I'm such a results-oriented person. I want instant gratification. I really can't believe I'm a printmaker because there is so much tediousness involved in it. But, you know, I love it, so I'm just persistent. The other thing printmaking is really good for, it's very, very good for first-time art buyers and for people that are just starting a collection. You know, prints by their nature, because there are more of them, they're less expensive. You can have wonderful art, you know, for $100 or $200.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend $10,000 to put something over your couch. You know, you can really have a beautiful print for much less money. $500 would buy you a pretty darn nice print.
Okay. Yeah, you can even get prints for, I would say, $60.
Yes.
And they may be artists that are emerging. They may be by recognized artists already. But it's a wonderful event to go looking at prints.
Can you tell people out there how the print is labeled so that they know just where in the bunch that were produced their own painting or their own print exists, you know?
Well, sometimes they're numbered, and there's a lot of kind of nefarious numbering systems in printmaking. AP means artist proof, and traditionally that meant that the publisher would get 50 and the artist would get 3 or 4 themselves, and then they wouldn't really get paid till the 50 were sold, so they would get 3 or 4 they could sell, and then they would have some money. TP means trial proof. WP means working proof. So as you're developing things and changing colors, you know, you'll do a print and then maybe it won't be what the edition is like. One of the things I would encourage all of your viewers to do, listeners?
Okay.
All your listeners to do.
Are you guys
do.
Watching?
They're having to visualize.
Exactly. During the month of December, Print Arts Northwest in our gallery, we're doing a show called Deck the Walls. And what we're doing is we're putting up a lot of small prints that are framed, ready for gift giving. And what you can do is just come in, buy it, and take it off the wall and take it home that very day. It's not like an exhibition where you have to leave it till the end of the show. You can take it as you buy it. And so, you know, that's kind of a fun thing to do. We're going to hang it salon style, so there'll be an awful lot of work by an awful lot of people. And because the work is all going to be fairly small, it should be reasonably priced.
Well, sure.
And it would
that's
be,
good. Yeah.
It'll be interesting technically. I mean, you can look at a wall and see all kinds of styles and approaches and ask yourself, well, what do I like and what don't I like? I often learn a lot from what I don't like.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, that you can give as a gift, which I almost forgot to say, and I'm sure they'd shoot me when we got back, was that a membership to Print Arts Northwest, because we are an educational nonprofit.
I was going to ask you this question. Yes. Very important. Please listen, everybody.
You can join Print Arts Northwest as a supporter, and it will give you a discount on anything you buy, so it's very worthwhile to do it. Our beginning membership is $75, and it supports our organization. We do, as I said, a lot of educational outreach. We're trying to educate the world about prints and printmaking and also support our printmakers.
And do you have somebody in there who can advise with people and tell them what an etching is differently from a lithograph and
we
so
sure
forth
do.
And
we
so
sure
forth?
Do.
Because I think that's important to know what you're looking at, what the process was.
Yes, and of course, all of our work has a disclosure statement on the back. In Oregon, there's a law that anything that that sells that's art, that's original art, has to have this disclosure statement that says what it is, how many there were, when it was made, how many in the edition. You know, it just gives you all the information.
Yeah.
So that comes with every piece of work.
And another thing is it's very easy for you to meet the artists and spend some time with them. It can be at an opening, or you can engage them in different ways. There also, we have workshops, lectures, sometimes studio tours.
Okay, so if you become a member, you get all this material, and you can call some number to how do you have all the information on
our
a little
website.
Folder.
Yeah, our website is a good place to get it. It's printartsnw.org.
One more time.
Printartsnw.org.
That's printartsnorthwest.org.
Right.
Okay, that's good. We'll have to do that again. We're almost to the end of this show, and I didn't even take time to ID the show, and I must do that right now.
Well, you know.
It's 90.7 FM, excuse me, and that's Portland. 91.9 FM Columbia Gorge, 100.7 FM in the Willamette Valley. And we're going all the way to Corvallis and Salem and all around. So see where your voices are this morning.
Wow.
I hope they're all watching.
That's like printmaking. We're doing multiples of our voice. One exciting thing is that I think that Print Arts Northwest is beginning to reposition itself for the 21st century. And it's a very exciting time for print arts. And we're looking forward to other folks joining us, getting involved, and just having a lot of fun with us. So come down, visit, participate. You may be a frustrated artist like I was, and who knows, you may become one.
Yes, well, we would invite all your listeners in the month of November to see George Johansson and Jack McClarty's show at Print Arts Northwest. It's on 12th Avenue between Gleason and Flanders in Northwest Portland. See the show at PNCA, the wonderful juried show. That's also up all through November. And then in December, we have the Japanese Printmaker Show Contemporary Art at Waterstone Gallery and the Deck the Halls, I guess it's Deck the Walls show, at Print Arts Northwest right next door. Both of those galleries, as I said, are on 12th, located between Gleason and Flanders.
We also have a third wonderful show out at PCC, Portland Community College, Mount Sylvania, which features selected artists' early work and a later work that they've done side by side.
It's called Then and Now. It's a very interesting to see somebody's work 20 years ago and see it now. And some of it looks totally different, and others you can see.
And
really
it's called Then and Now.
Then and Now.
Wonderful. That's a lovely thing to do.
You know, Print Arts represents about 7 states, including Alaska and Hawaii. There's even a member in China. And because of that, it's truly a regional opportunity to experience art. And we have traveling shows, which are quite interesting and fun. And we'd love to have people participate in that by helping with them or finding venues where shows might be shown. Or if you have a friend that you think might be a frustrated printmaker or lover of art, send them to us.
And then where would they go to make their prints?
There are many different kinds of opportunities. We don't have a pan dedicated print studio at the moment, but we can put you in touch with other artists and workshops, Inkling Studio, Atelier Mars. Many artists will use schools like the College of Arts and Crafts or PNCA as actual studios. And
I teach in my own studio, so there's a lot of opportunity to learn.
Okay. Well, this morning we have not really, we've gotten pretty far into the subject, but not far enough. We should have had an hour so we could talk a little bit more about what the different prints and what they are, whether what the difference between an etching and a lithograph.
We'll come back soon
and
we'll
so
do that
forth.
Program.
And then I'd also like to talk about the law. What the law says about what you can do or what you can't do with a print that you may have. For instance, you can't make copies of a print and hand them out to a bunch of people. Can you do that?
Work is copyrighted. No.
No, you can't do it.
No.
And you know how many people don't know that?
Oh, I'm sure it's those are the same people in the Kinko's Xeroxing music.
We got to wind up, and I'm going on to an entirely other subject, and I didn't mean to do that, but it's interesting. Well, come back again soon.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And if printmakers do it backwards, when we say goodbye, we actually mean hello. Come see us.
Come and see us, definitely.
Okay. That is good. And we've been talking to Barbara Mason this morning.
Yes.
And Stephen Lafleur, and thanks so much for taking the time from your very busy days. I really appreciate it, especially this time of year.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
It was fun. And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
Oh, and I cut you off, Julie. I'm so terrible. Well, you got to stay tuned now for Democracy Now! And, next time I think Potato Prince. That's got to be on there. We can all do our own Potato Prince. Stay tuned now for a Democracy Now! An Argentine torture survivor talks about her return to the police station where she was abused, and an editor at the Los Angeles Times discusses how he was forced out of his job after he rejected job cuts. All that coming up on the Radio Zine and Democracy Now! Stay tuned.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
First, I remember feeling something cold on my stomach, and then I felt it. I felt the first electric shock. You feel this burning pain. It's a horrible thing.
Torture survivor Patricia Isaza. She was 16 when she was kidnapped by Argentine police and soldiers. She was tortured, held prisoner without trial for 2.5 years before she joins thousands at Fort Benning, Georgia, to protest what used to be called the School of the Americas. Patricia Isaza joins us in our Firehouse studio to tell her story and of her lifelong campaign to bring her torturers to justice. Then the publisher and editor of the Los Angeles Times are forced out by their new owner, the Tribune Company. We'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning LA Times journalist Henry Weinstein about the effects of media consolidation on the newsrooms of America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Guardian of London is reporting the Bush administration is planning what sources call a last big push to win the war in Iraq. Rather than face growing calls for a phased withdrawal, the administration is considering adding up to 20,000 new U.S. troops on the ground. The White House plan is said to be affecting how the Iraq Study Group is conducting its own deliberations on how to advise the president. A former senior administration official said President Bush believes achieving U.S. goals in Iraq is, quote, a matter of political will. The official added the Iraq Study Group and Last Push strategy are intended to give Republicans political time and space to recover from their election loss in time for the 2008 presidential race. The official concluded, quote, what they're going to say is lower the goals, forget about the democracy crap, put more resources in, do it. The news comes one day after the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East testified against both a withdrawal and an increase of U.S. troops in Iraq. Speaking before the Senate Armed Services Committee Wednesday, General John Abizaid was questioned by Arizona Senator John McCain.
I respect you enormously. I appreciate your service. I regret deeply that you seem to think that the status quo and the rate of progress we're making is acceptable. I think most Americans do not.
Well, Senator, I agree with you. The status quo is not acceptable. And I don't believe what I'm saying here today is the status quo. I am saying we must significantly increase our ability to help the Iraqi army by putting more American troops with Iraqi units in military transition teams to speed the amount of training that is done, to speed the amount of heavy weapons that gets there, and to speed the ability of Iraqi troops to deploy.
In other Capitol Hill testimony Wednesday, a key Democratic Congress member called for direct negotiations with North Korea. Congressmember Tom Lantos is expected to head the House International Relations Committee when Democrats take over Congress in January.
Hardliners lodged in the office of the Vice President and the Defense Department must not be given a veto. Ambassador Hill must also make a stopover in Pyongyang on his way back from the six-party talks. Not to negotiate a new and separate deal, but rather to demonstrate to Pyongyang our peaceful intent.
Also Wednesday, the Senate heard testimony. Al-Qaeda's strength and influence in Afghanistan is on the rise. CIA Director Michael Hayden said U.S. troops will be needed in Afghanistan for at least a decade to ensure the government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai is not overthrown. A U.S. Army specialist has become the first of five suspects to plead guilty in the rape of a young Iraqi teenager and the killing of her and her family. On Wednesday, the soldier, Specialist James Barker, described how he and three others carried out the rape of the girl, 14-year-old Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, in the village of Mahmoudiya. Barker said Sergeant Paul Cortez held the girl to the ground while her parents and young sister were shot dead in the next room. These soldiers later burned Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi's body in an effort to cover up the crime. Barker will be spared the death penalty in return for his testimony. In another case Wednesday, a Marine private who pleaded guilty to taking part in the murder of an Iraqi civilian was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The Marine, Private First Class John Jodka, is the youngest and lowest ranked of the seven charged for the murder of Hashim Ibrahim Awad in Hamdaniya. The Marine shot Awad after pulling him from his home last April. They initially tried to cover up the slaying by placing a rifle at the scene to give the appearance Awad was an insurgent. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, incumbent Joseph Kabila has been declared winner of the country's presidential elections. It was Congo's first presidential election in 40 years. Kabila's opponent, former rebel leader Jean-Pierre Bemba, is refusing to concede the race. In Pakistan, lawmakers have voted to remove rape from the jurisdiction of Islamic law and put it under the Civil Penal Code. Women's rights groups have long campaigned for the change. Under Islamic laws, rape victims are liable for prosecution for adultery unless they can produce four male witnesses. Pakistani Prime Minister Shaukat Aziz hailed the measure as a historic change.
This is part of a process through which women will get their rights. This will help to lessen to a great extent the unfair and illegal treatment meted out to women. But we are fully aware of the fact that we still have a lot more to do.
While an alliance of Islamic parties opposed the change, at least one party said the measure doesn't go far enough. The Pakistan People's Party is calling on Parliament to repeal all Islamic laws it calls anti-women and discriminatory. Meanwhile, in Turkey, an Arab delegation to a European Union conference on the role of women in society said foreign occupation is hampering the movement for women's equality. This is Palestinian Deputy Minister for Women's Affairs, Sawa Hudib.
In the end, there are basic rights under international law to protect women and generally to protect people under occupation. But with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the world remains silent to please Israel, which is unjust and not balanced. We have called on the international community, the United Nations, and everyone who affects decision-making in the Middle East to protect Palestinians and Palestinian women and children.
The delegation's comments come on the heels of a report this week from a UN panel formed to improve relations between Muslim and Western societies. The panel, called the Alliance of Civilizations, concluded the Israel-Palestinian conflict is the driving force behind tensions between Muslims and the West. The report concludes, quote, the Israeli-Palestinian issue has taken on a symbolic value that colors cross-cultural and political relations well beyond its limited geographic scope. Overall, the report argued the Israel-Palestine conflict is one example of why global division should not be seen in terms of a, quote, clash of civilizations, but rather geopolitical conflicts. The report's authors include Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu and former Iranian President Mohammad Khatami. in Iran. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said today his government is nearing the, quote, final step in developing its nuclear program. Ahmadinejad did not provide details. He's already announced Iran will celebrate its, quote, right to nuclear technology by the end of the Iranian year in March. His comments come 2 days after an unidentified senior of U.S. official told the Reuters news agency the Bush administration would be open to bombing North Korea and Iran. The official said, quote, "We, the United States, and others who might be threatened by these developments will have to look at how to respond, and inevitably, I think people will have to look at the question of preemption," he said. Here in the United States, Senator Trent Lott was voted back into the ranks of the Republican leadership in Congress Wednesday with his election as Senate Minority Whip. The position is the Republicans' second highest in the Senate. The vote comes nearly 4 years after Lott was forced to resign as Senate Majority Leader after making what many considered racially insensitive remarks. The comments came at a 100th birthday celebration for the late former Senator Strom Thurmond, in which Lott appeared to endorse Thurmond's run for president in 1948. Thurmond ran his campaign on a pro-segregation, anti-civil rights platform. One of the slogans for his campaign was "Segregation Forever." These were Trent Lott's remarks.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Senator Lott's return is already coming under criticism. Democratic Congressmember Melvin Watt, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, said, quote, "For many African Americans, the sting of Trent Lott's hurtful words are unlikely to expire anytime soon." When asked Wednesday whether he had any further comments to make about the 1948 presidential race, Senator Lott replied, quote, "No, no, not at all." In Louisiana, a state court official has argued for overturning the murder conviction of a former Black Panther who's been held in solitary confinement for more than 30 years. Wallace and two others are known as the Angola Three. Prisoners' rights groups believe they've been held in solitary confinement at Louisiana's Angola prison because of their involvement with the Black Panthers. In Nevada, the town of Pahrump has passed an ordinance that makes English the official language, restricts the display of foreign flags, and denies benefits to undocumented workers. The American Civil Liberties Union is already vowing to challenge the measure in court. And finally, an internal governmental audit has found nearly all the money spent on, quote, democracy promotion in Cuba over the last decade has been spent without proper oversight. The Government Accountability Office says some $74 million in contracts from the U.S. Agency for International Development have been prone to waste and fraud. In one case, a Miami-based group that won a contract to provide humanitarian assistance to Cuba spent the money on goods including video games, cashmere sweaters, and a gas chainsaw. Arizona Republican Congressmember Jeff Flake, who backed the audit, said the findings suggest the Bush and Clinton administrations used the programs to curry favor with right-wing Cuban exile groups. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the United States and around the world. Thousands are expected to converge in Fort Benning, Georgia this weekend for the annual protest calling for the closure of the School of the Americas. The school, now known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, was created 60 years ago as a military training facility for Latin American military and police. There have been hundreds of documented human rights abuses connected to soldiers trained at the school. In 1996, the Pentagon released school training manuals that advocated torture, extortion, and execution. Despite this, there has never been an independent investigation of the school. In 2004, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced that Venezuela would no longer send soldiers to train at the School of the Americas. Earlier this year, the governments of Uruguay and Argentina followed suit. Argentina in particular has a sordid history with the school. When SOA graduate Leopoldo Galtieri headed Argentina's military during the country's dictatorship, 30,000 people were killed or disappeared.
One of those who disappeared but lived to tell her story is Patricia Isaza. She was only 16 in 1976 when she was kidnapped by police and soldiers, tortured and held prisoner without trial for 2.5 years. One of Patricia's torturers was Domingo Marcellini. He's a graduate of the School of the Americas. A documentary about Patricia's ordeal and her subsequent investigation to bring her torturers to justice premiered on Argentine television last May. It's called El Cerco, and it features interviews with some of her torturers who are now in prison awaiting trial. In the film, Patricia Sassa revisits the sites where she was held, and she describes her torture. This is an excerpt.
I arrived here for the first time when I was 16 years old, July 30 at noon. They forced me through this hallway. This place was empty. First, they slammed me against the wall. They dragged me across the floor. They beat me. Then they tied my feet to my hands, which were already handcuffed. I was kept like this for 1 week. Two men appeared, and one of them told me I had to talk. He said that the other guy was crazy, and I should talk for my own good. This crazy guy was Eduardo Ramos.
I entered the police force in 1973. While I was working for the police as an analyst, the government was overthrown. My job was to monitor terrorist groups in universities. Some people call it going undercover.
After 2 days, they took the hood off me. They gave me water, a lemon, and they took me to the bathroom. Then Ramos and the other guy came back playing good cop and bad cop. I was told that Ramos going to kill me and I'd better talk.
I was not a typical policeman. I was more of a secret agent than a regular cop.
I was from here. Ramos gave me a warning. He was insinuating that I would be raped. He said, tell me if anyone touches you. Because we are the only ones that can touch you. I was 16 years old. I couldn't believe it. Ramos was telling me, you are my property. If I want, I can rob you. Ramos was a spy at this law school. He turned in a lot of students here while pretending he was a law student. My next step was to reconstruct my captivity at Police Station 4, where I learned what it was like to be tortured. This was a camp of torture and extermination run by Mario José Facino in 1976. Over here, this is it. It is this place. And this here. It's both of these. These are the places where they torture us. We are looking at them from the outside, but I'm convinced, I'm telling you. I can't talk. Look, This is it. This is the place. They were over here, on this floor and this window. This is where I spent the worst days of my life. Simple as that. This was stuck, but they managed to open it. And through here you could see, as you can now, the school. You can manage to see the school. This crack, if you excuse me, this was stuck. You couldn't open it. But to be able to see the school, I could suspect what street I was on and where I was being held. After talking with other detainees, we figured out that we were being held at the police station 4. I never thought that I would be standing in front of the bench that I was locked to. It's incredible. 20, 25 years have passed. The bench that I was locked to when I was 16 is still here, sound as ever. No one came to look at this place. There's a case in Spain, a case in Argentina, and a case in Santa Fe 15 blocks away from here, and no one was capable of coming over to look at this. I have to be the one to show it to you. This is where I had to force myself not to use the bathroom. I was sent to an absolutely filthy room to pee. This was the only place where you could drink a little bit of water, and it is all still here. Everything is still here because no one has been held accountable. And there you could clearly see the cells. They were 3 feet by 4 feet. You couldn't even lay down inside the cell. This was the central area where they tortured us. In 1976, the man responsible for the torture was Fasino.
I was not involved in any repressive group or anything like that. I was the supervisor of police station number 4 in Santa Fe. I had an important job. My job was to detain people who at that time were called subversives. Subversive delinquents.
They put a hood on my head and tied my wrist to a wrinkly old bed. First, I remember feeling something cold on my stomach, and then I felt it. I felt the first electric shock. You feel this burning pain. It's a horrible thing. They also humiliated me. They were laughing at me. They ejaculated onto me. They were enjoying themselves.
She says they tortured her there. She says that they would lift off her hood and rape her. I doubt all of it.
I recognize this place. This is it. I won't forget it. I mean, this was the floor. I'm totally sure. And I was here 3 days, the worst 3 days of my life.
A minor detained for subversive activities? No, no. It's a lie. The woman, Patricia Isaza, says that the police detained her and she knows who detained her and where. Why, she says it was at police station number 4. I don't know. I honestly don't. But I can't recall whether we detained her or not. But if we look at her records, it has to be recorded where she was detained, when she was detained, and who detained her.
I started working at the federal court as a student. When the government was overthrown, I was employee of the court.
Yo ejercía la función de
I was 27, 28 years old. As a secretary for the judge, I would take statements. In the office of the police station. The head of the police station had us take statements. Nothing more.
They would hit you. They would torture you. They would hound you. Then they would pick you up and open this door for you. You would go through this door. And whom would you find on the other side? Bruce. This man was on the other side of the door. He would be writing, and he would take out a sheet of paper. You would be all beaten up, bleeding, naked. He'd throw you some clothes, and then he'd say, "Here, sign this. Bruce."
An excerpt of El Cerco, The Circle, produced by the Argentine television station Telefe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Patricia Sassa joins us live in studio. Stay with us.
Si no creyera en la locura de la garganta del sinsonte, si no creyera que en el monte se esconde el trino y la pavura, si no creyera en la balanza, en la razón del equilibrio, si no creyera en el delirio, si no creyera en la esperanza, si no creyera en lo que agencio, si no creyera en mi camino, si no creyera en mi sonido, si no creyera en mi silencio, ay, qué cosa fuera, qué cosa fuera.
Argentine singer Mercedes Sosa singing La Masa, The Masses. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Nine of Patricia Isasa's torturers are in prison awaiting trial. In September, the Argentine president, Néstor Kirchner, ordered her into a witness protection program. This was after the disappearance of Jorge Julio López, another torture survivor, who'd recently testified against his abuser. Patricia is scheduled to testify against her torturers in the coming months. She joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome, Patricia.
Welcome.
What are you doing in the United States?
Well, I've been here because I received some threats and in
some death threats.
Yes, in my house and in my office, and I'm better here. And I came here because tomorrow I will stay in the demonstration to try to close the School of America, because it's a school with assassins in general, but special is a school who give the training with the most responsibility person in my case. The name with this person is Marcellini, Domingo Marcellini. He received training in the School of America, a terrible training, you know, in the School of America, when you come in, you are a soldier, but you came out, you became an assassin, because they train in about the torture. They have different techniques about the torture. And this is terrible. It's terrible. It's not only for me. It's terrible for a lot of people. The School of America start the road to Abu Ghraib. But in this road, firstly, they pass for Latin America. And in Latin America, they take away the life with a lot of people, and this is the point, because it is very important to close the School of America, because it's an immoral place.
Now, you mentioned Domingo Marcellini. Yes. Now, he was one of the people, a graduate who was actually involved directly in your torture. And could you talk about his involvement and what happened with you?
Well, what happened with me, the military kidnapped me when I was 16 years old. And
you're in school?
I'm in the high school. I was an honor student. And I'm involved in student activities, only this. And I represent some students. I represent my students in the government with the school, only this.
The student government?
Yes.
And this was in the city of Santa Fe?
This is in the city of Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And then they kidnapped me. I've been disappeared for 3 months. What is disappeared? Disappeared is when nobody knows where you are and you don't know where you are. In fact, when I watched, when I saw one lady who stayed disappeared, I understand where I am and what happened with me. Because I understand in this moment when I watch, oh, he's disappeared, but he's alive, he's here, I'm
because
here.
Because you knew before you were disappeared,
yes,
that this woman was disappeared.
Yes.
So you understood,
yes,
you had met,
yes,
the same fate.
And the first point is when these guys talk to you, they say, you are murdered. Nobody know where you are. You don't know where you are. And we are God.
Hmm. What was happening with your family, with your dad, was your mother alive at the time?
Yes, my mother alive. My mother and my father tried to phone me for month and month and month, and finally my father tried to phone my body, and finally I appear.
How did you appear?
Probably, I don't know. I need some answers. I try to find justice to have these answers. Why they kidnapped me? Why I released? Why they tortured me? Why? I need to know why exactly. I need this answer. For 30 years, I need this answer. I try to find this answer. It's not only for me. It's for my family, for the memory with my mom, and for the Argentine people. We need an answer. Why they make these crimes? Why they make this massacre against their own people? Because Marcellini was Argentine. It's unbelievable, but he's Argentine. He trained in a soldier, but he became in an assassin. He fight against their own people, and he broke the honor with the military. When the military have an honor, I hope to have an honor. And what is the honor for the military? You can't to kill another other people who don't have a gun. And they kill not the people who don't have a gun. They kill innocent people, undressed people. They kill a lot of people. This is, well, they broke with the honor.
Let me ask you, after they held you for 2.5 years, when they finally released you, what were the circumstances? What did they say when they released you? Where did they leave you? Or
I remember what they say. They told me, if you told this story, nobody believe you. Because it's unbelievable. But I say for myself, I'm going to tell this story. It's not only for me, because for me it happened. More or less, but it happened. But to don't repeat. Some people need to know what happened in Argentina, need to know what happened in all the clandestine jails around the world, because today we have a lot of clandestine jails, look like Guantanamo, for example, and Abu Ghraib, to know.
Did you just show up at your house after 2.5 years? You just show up after they released you. Your parents had been looking for you for 2.5 years, assumed you were dead. You just showed up on the doorstep of your house and said, I am here?
No. My parents, when they released me, my parents meet with me firstly, and it's a special, really, a special and unbelievable moment, because I remember the first time all is strange, because I live in a small, for 2.5 years, I stayed in a small place. For 6 months, I stayed all the time, 24 hours, with a very strong lights, 24 hours for 6 months. for 6 months. And we don't know what day is the day, what time is it, and this is terrible. And finally, when I release, I remember the nature. Mm-hmm. Now the sun, the streets. When you release, you return to the life, and the life is great. And I think probably when I live in the concentration camp, when I have this strong experience, probably I reevaluate what's great is the life.
We're talking to Patricia Sasa, who when she was 16 was kidnapped, disappeared, tortured, raped, released 2.5 years later, about 10, 9, 8 years ago. You began this search.
Yes.
For the people who tortured you.
Yes.
How did you find them? It is you who have landed them in jail and who will testify against them. Where did you start?
Well, I start with a simple point, because this story is in a small town, and when you live in a small town, some people know each other, and I speak. I ask questions with different people, and I speak, and then I have a little simple information, and I took this information, I tried to phone more and more and more, and I found one document, but when I found one document, I found another and another and another, and then I found a lot of documents in different archives, with the police and with for the justice, for different archives, and then I make a very big search, and I explain what happened during the repression in Argentina, because in Argentina they tried to lie and said dirty war. It is not a war, because a war is two armies fight each other. It's not a war, it's a lie. It looks like the war in Iraq is not a war, it's invasion. What is the other army in Iraq? Iraq don't have an army now. What is the other army? What is? Don't have. They fight against the innocent people. And they kill a lot of people, a lot of innocent people, kids, old ladies, men. It's not a war. What is a problem for the humanity? War is not a solution for the humanity. We need peace. We need to think about peace. We need to give peace a chance.
Well, let me ask you, when you began to do the search and gather the documents, some things had changed in Argentina, but not everything. At least the military dictatorship was ended by then. But you had to go outside of the country first, right? Mm-hmm. You went to the famous Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzón. Could you talk about that, why you felt the need to go outside of the country?
Yes, because for 20 years we have an impunity law. They stop the justice for 20 years. But it's no more different than today. Yesterday, I watched in the news, one group with lawyers tried to find justice against Ramphil, a terrible criminal, in German. If you don't have justice in your country, you need to find justice in any places. It's a tragedy, because I need to cross the ocean with all of my documents, and I showed the document for Baltasar Garzón. I spoke for more than five hours, and finally he told me, what can I do? I said, please, request for these people.
And just to be clear, Baltasar Garzón is the famous judge who went after Pinochet when he was in Britain, the dictator of Chile, and had him detained. Yeah. So you went to him, the documents, and so what did he do?
He requested an international request for these criminals, and finally, during 2001, they stayed for a short time in jail, the perpetrators, in my case, they stayed for a few times, 39 days, and then, because to try to to go to Madrid, because Baltasar Garzón gave the international request to the police.
So, in other words, he issued an arrest order of them to be extradited to Spain?
Yes, to try to extradite with them. But the president, De La Rúa, signed to don't extradite. But the point is, if you sign to don't extradite, to don't give the extradition, you need to open a trial. And I open a trial, finally, I open a trial in Argentina. In 2002, but I need to wait 2, 3, 4 years more to open, finally, to real open a trial, and now these perpetrators are in jail, and we're waiting we said oral trial is a...
So they haven't actually been tried, they're held in jail, and
yes,
they're awaiting trial. And
yes,
we're talking about their positions today. One was a mayor.
What?
Of Santa Fe.
Yes, he's in jail. One is a mayor, another is the point is this. The boss with the concentration camps, 25 years later, became in a mayor. The interrogator with the torture place, 25 years later, he became in a federal judge.
A judge?
Yes, federal judge, a powerful man. The group with the torture, the people who torture you directly, who rob you, who put the picanama, these kind of people became in a very powerful people in the police, in a high position with
and
the police.
And you showed all of them their addresses,
yes,
where they were, and so they were picked up.
Yes, the ID, all, and some documents who, I found some documents who they signed to kidnap people, for example, because they have a very important bureaucracy. They are bureaucrats.
Bureaucrats.
Yes, they're bureaucrats. Yes.
And you mentioned earlier that for 20 years there was a law of impunity. In effect, what happened is after the military dictatorship, there was a deal made that there would not be prosecution of those who had conducted the terrorism. Was that what happened?
No. During the first time with the democracy period, we have a trial against the high position in the military, a trial against the junta, the comandantes, we said in Spanish. But during 1987, they tried to make a coup, and then they make a deal, and it happened, the impunity law. And we have this impunity law for 15 years. Last 2004, President Kirchner take away the impunity law.
So it was President Kirchner who basically paved the way for the people down the chain of command who participated in the torture to be held responsible.
Yes, he opened the door to make a trial in Argentina.
And Patricia, it is the president, Kirchner, who has put you under protection,
yes,
ever since what happened in September. September 18th,
yes,
Jorge Julio López,
yes,
went missing. A day before, the former police commissioner, Miguel Echecolatz, was sentenced to life in prison for the murder, torture, and kidnapping of 6 people.
Mm.
900 former officers and collaborators from the military dictatorship could reportedly face trial right now, face charges.
Yes.
So when you are in Argentina, you're under protection.
Yes.
When do you testify? Are you afraid to return? You have tens of thousands of people. What, 100,000 protesters marched in the streets of Buenos Aires in October demanding the release of Jorge Julio López, but he's gone now, went missing twice.
Yeah.
First, when he was captured in the 1970s and tortured, and now again.
Yes, probably the paramilitary killed him. We suppose they killed him.
So why would you return?
Because it's my compromise with my life. Because I need to find justice. Because Argentina is my place, is my home. Because I have rights to return. Because I talk about the truth. Because I need answers. And I try to find this answer for the trials in my own place because I have rights to stay in this place. And the perpetrators, we need to take away, to put in jail with a good trial. I never have a trial, but I try, they have a trial. I never have a defense. They never show me the proof, but I prefer we are going to show the proof for them. They need to make a good trial because we need a justice. Because we need to mark a line to divide the crazy people, the bad people, the assassin people with the normal people. The normal people we need to live in peace.
Patrice Sasa, I want to thank you very much for being with us as you head now down to Fort Benning, Georgia, to join thousands of people protesting the training of Latin American officers at the Georgia base. Thank you for joining us. We'll continue to follow your story. Also, special thanks to the Democracy Now! Producers who helped translate this documentary to Elizabeth Press and to John Hamilton. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a special day. Juan will be here in New York with Alice Walker, the great writer, and I will be in Miami with Isabel Allende, and we'll spend the hour with these two women, with these two great authors. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're talking about media consolidation. Stay with us.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo, cambia el modo de pensar, cambia todo en este mundo. Cambia el clima con los años, cambia el pastor su rebaño, y así como todo cambia, que yo cambie no es extraño. Brillante, de mano en mano su brillo, cambia el nido el pajarillo, cambia el sentir un amante, cambia el rumbo el caminante, aunque esto le cause daño, y así como todo cambia, que yo cambie no es extraño, cambia todo cambia.
Todo cambia, everything changes, by the great Argentine singer Mercedes Sosa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR radio stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org, and our headlines are available in Spanish, in transcript, and in audio form for any radio station to take around the world. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In an effort to cut costs, the owners of many of the nation's newspapers are slashing the amount of money spent on reporting and laying off staff. The impact of these mass layoffs is expected to be widely felt. Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post recently wrote, quote, if this erosion continues, it would be bad for news, for serious journalism, and good news for corrupt politicians. Kurtz points out that journalists played key roles in exposing recent Washington scandals, including those involving Jack Abramoff and Mark Foley.
On an almost daily basis, reports have emerged about more newspaper layoffs. On Tuesday, the executive editor of the Washington Post, Leonard Downey Jr., announced plans to shrink the newsroom staff as part of a major transformation of the paper. On Monday, the St. Paul Pioneer Press in Minnesota said it would cut 40 full-time positions at the paper. Last week, the new owners of the Philadelphia Inquirer forced out the paper's editor, Amanda Bennett.
Employees at the Inquirer fear the paper's new owners will lay off as many as a third of its newsroom staff. In California, the owners of the Los Angeles Daily News recently laid off the paper's publisher and 20 other employees. 101 jobs are being eliminated at the San Jose Mercury News, another 111 at the Dallas Morning News. The Cleveland Plain Dealer plans to cut 17% of its staff.
But the most turmoil might be at the Los Angeles Times, the nation's fourth largest newspaper. 2 months ago, the paper's publisher, Jeffrey Johnson, and its top editor, Dean Baquet, publicly defied calls by executives at Tribune Company to eliminate more newsroom positions. Johnson was ousted in October. Baquet was forced out last week. A columnist for the trade magazine editor and publisher said about Baquet's firing, "It is a sign that no editor who makes news first and big profits second is safe."
One of the most outspoken critics of the changes at the Los Angeles Times has been Henry Weinstein, the paper's legal affairs reporter. He's worked for the paper for 28 years. He this week came to New York to be awarded the John Chancellor Award for Excellence by Columbia University School of Journalism. Henry Weinstein joins us in our Firehouse studio today. Welcome.
It's great to be here for the first time as a regular listener to the show in Los Angeles and a longtime supporter of Pacific. I'm very very good to be here. One of the first things I did when I moved to Los Angeles was to help put on a big fundraiser for Pacific at the Los Angeles train station, where we honored the great journalist Kerry McWilliams. So it's particularly nice to be here today, particularly at a time when, as you were talking about, the situation for a lot of dark clouds over the media these days. A lot of dark clouds.
Especially over newspapers, daily newspapers.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about what is the mood right now at the Times staff?
Well, I think that people were very angry about the fact that both our publisher and then just last week our editor, Dean Baquet, were shown the door. You know, sometimes when an executive gets fired, it's because he's failed to perform a good job or there's been some ethical lapse. Here, it was just the opposite of that. Dean Baquet's done a great job as an editor. The paper, you know, he was the managing editor, the editor over the past 6 years, a period where the Times, despite cutting 250 editorial staffers and having its marketing budgets, last paper won 13 Pulitzer Prizes. Basically, what he was shown the door for was drawing a line in the sand about staff cutbacks. And the reason he was drawing a line in the sand was because he's concerned that if the size of our staff is reduced, it's not going to be just a matter of job reduction, but it's going to mean that we're going to reduce the number of stories we're doing, and that's going to be a detriment to the community and to the people that read us online around the world and around the country. So it's a serious issue at our paper, and if you look at all these other papers, reducing staff is going to mean reducing coverage, and that's going to create a news vacuum that's important to a citizen of this country.
And the amazing thing is that in most of these, virtually all of these newspapers, it's not a question that they're not making money. I think, for instance, the Knight Ridder chain, before it went under, was making about a 15 or more percent return. It's that they're not making enough money for the demands of especially the institutional shareholders and others, right?
That's absolutely right, Juan. Our paper made about a 20% rate of return last year. Clearly, a lot of corporations in this country would be very happy to make a 20% rate of return, but Wall Street, you know, considers newspapers to be a quote-unquote mature industry. A mature industry is one that they consider to not have a lot of near-term growth prospects, so they demand even higher rates of return. Some of them would like us to have 25 or 30% profit. Well, I suppose we could probably make that rate of profit if we reduce the size substantially again, but, I mean, I understand that we operate in a capitalist society and that newspapers have to make some money to grow and prosper. On the other hand, newspapers have another role. They have a vital role in informing people in this country. That's, you know, we have a protection under the First Amendment because it's considered to have a vital role. And I think, and this paper's already had cuts, you know, and the question is, I think Dean was trying to send an important message is, where do you stop? Where do you stop? Just to crystallize this issue in another way, on Dean's last day, you know, it's fairly typical in newsrooms when somebody's going to leave, they put out a mock front page sort of celebrating some of the person's achievements and some humor. And there was a lot of that, but one thing was really, our sports columnist, Bill Plaschke, try to cast this with an analogy by saying it was as if Baquet was being asked to cut his shortstop, his right fielder, and his first baseman into play with six guys. And the question is, just where do you stop?
So the announcement came on the eve of the midterm election coverage at the Los Angeles Times.
That is
he's out right
that
after.
Is correct. Yes, that was a very incredible day. I walked back from the cafeteria just after lunch. There was a bulletin moved on Dow Jones that he was out. A bunch of us walked down to his office and we said, "Is this true?" And he said, "Yes, it's true." And he then put out an announcement to the staff. We had a staff meeting and then people carried on and put out a very good election edition.
The Chicago Tribune has taken over your paper, the Tribune Company that owns the Chicago Tribune?
Well, I mean, when you said the Tribune bought the Los Angeles Times in 2000 in the aftermath of the Staples scandal, the Staples ethics scandal.
Wait, but not just the Times, the Times Mirror
owned a number of newspapers, Newsday, the Baltimore Sun, the Hartford Courant, Allentown's paper, and then some other papers, and then the Tribune. Now it's very large. There's a bunch of television stations. And so now the whole company is on the block. You know, we've got bids from equity investors in various places. Gannett's got an offer. There's three billionaires in Los Angeles who have expressed interest in buying the newspaper.
David Geffen among them.
David Geffen has said that he's interested. We don't know that he's made a formal bid, but two other guys have gotten together. Ron Burkel, a supermarket mogul, and Eli Brode.
And a personal friend of Bill Clinton.
And yes, Burkel is a good friend of Bill Clinton and not a friend of one reporter, at least from the New York Post. So the question is now is, you know, what kind of owner will we have next? It seems like there will be a new owner. The paper could be, I mean, the entire company could be broken up in several directions. And the main thing I think people on the staff are concerned about is that we want to have an owner that's interested in, you know, investing in the paper, trying to make the paper grow, improving our capacity on the Internet so we can better serve our readers.
Dean Baquet was one of the highest ranking African Americans in the newspaper industry.
He was the highest ranking. He was certainly the first African American to be the top editor at a major American newspaper that I'm aware of.
Well, there's also Greg Moore at the Denver Post,
right.
But LA Times is a bigger city, yes.
Juan, as president, former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, you have been really honing in on, really focusing on the effect of media consolidation on people of color in this country, around ownership, around who's covered.
Well, I mean, clearly, we discussed last week the situation with NBC, where NBC, when in its concentration, announced that since they own the Telemundo network, that they were eliminating local news programming in six cities. Not news programming, but locally originated news programming in six cities. And we're not talking small cities. We're talking San Jose, Phoenix, Dallas,
San Antonio,
Houston, and Denver. So we're talking about huge cities that they're just going to no longer have a locally originated news program. So this is an enormous problem that we're finding in terms of being able to get at a time when the country is changing dramatically the sufficient level of staffing to be able to really get into so many of the different communities that we're covering, whether it's in TV or newspapers.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I think it's a very, very distressing development. It's bad for the peoples and those individual communities, and collectively, it's bad for the nation. We need to have as many voices as we can. We need to have independent voices. That's why I think this program plays such a vital role, particularly as the large television networks have way cut back on their coverage abroad, and anything that companies are doing that that is diminishing the amount of news is bad. And frankly, I think that perhaps the FCC ought to take a look in this.
You're here for a major award. You've also won the Pulitzer Prize. You have been focusing on issues local, national, international. What do you think are the key issues that are not being covered today in this last minute?
Well, I think that one of the as you have diminished quality, diminished staffing, you have particularly a lot of cutback in the coverage of foreign news. I mean, CBS used to have a vast amount of foreign coverage. I think they're down to three or four bureaus. I'm very happy that our newspaper still has 22 foreign bureaus that I think provided just a vital service. I mean, covering foreign news is very difficult. I have colleagues working in Baghdad and a lot of other war zones, places where I know you've been. It's very, very difficult to cover these stories. It's very expensive. There are security issues, communications issues with sat phones. So, and I always think that there's never enough stories about poor people in this country. And to the extent that news budgets tend to get squeezed, then stories that are more difficult, investigative stories, are the ones that tend to get squeezed more. So it's just a really bad development.
Death penalty, you've also.
And then I've written a lot on the death penalty, a subject that is not also nearly covered enough. So just in general, I think The less resources that you have, it tends to increase the tendency to cover the easier stories, and that's not good for an individual community or for the country or the world.
Well, Henry Weinstein, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations again for the John Chancellor Award. We won't say for lifetime achievement because we don't want to suggest that in any way you are leaving journalism. Thank you.
Absolutely.
For being here.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you on this coast, and that does it for today's broadcast. Tomorrow I'll be broadcasting from Miami. Juan from here will be with Isabel Allende and Alice Walker. On Saturday, I'll be at the Miami Book Festival, and on Sunday at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, Jerome Bourgeois, John Randolph, Tyshawn Black, Danielle Strandberg Peshkin, Angela Alston, Uri Galad. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
It is 12 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Masterpiece Hemp, Clothing with a Conscience for Men, Women, Children, and Pets. Open Monday through Saturday, 11 to 6:30 p.m., and Sunday, 12 to 5 p.m. Masterpiece Hemp helps you dress for your environment. It's located at 4314 Southeast Hawthorne. Information at 503-493-2366 or check them out at masterpiecehemp.com. And that's Masterpiece, P-E-A-C-E. And also, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by McMenamin's Crystal Ballroom, presenting Zero with Steve Kimmock, Jerry Joseph, Donna Jean Godshaw, Greg Antone, Martin Fierro, Melvin Seals, and more. Friday, November 17th, 8 p.m., doors at 9 p.m. 8 p.m. doors, 9 p.m. show. And tickets for this all-ages show are available at the Crystal Ballroom box office, 1332 West Burnside, or at Ticketmaster.com.